fleeting glimpses of things seen through a veil, darkly. Do we understand the meaning of these visions of life? Why we are here and how little of our existence we truly understand? Tonight we will talk of these things on The Other Side. Welcome to The Other Side. I am Jim Harold. So glad to be with you once again. And today is an example of we have a lot of interviews to get out and only so many shows to put them in. So you are the benefactor as a Plus Club member. We thank you for that. We're going to do one of my famous double headers, a two-parter, and it's going to be fascinating. We're going to start out with Chrissy Estell. We're going to talk about Seven Steps into Angel Light, a journey of self-discovery and spiritual empowerment. And that's a fascinating subject. And then in part two, we're going to talk about another one. And this one is a particular interest to me, out-of-body experiences. Our guest is going to be Julia Sellers, who writes under the pen name of Iris Kirst, and her book is I Have Seen It Tomorrow. And we're going to listen to this today, whenever that is for you. And here's Chrissy. And you know, when we think of angels, a lot of times there's pictures that come into our head from the movies and popular culture. But we have a guest today who says angels are very real and they can have a great impact in our life. I'm talking about Chrissy Estell. She is the author of the recent book, Seven Steps into Angel Light, a journey of self-discovery and spiritual empowerment. And Chrissy is one of the most experienced angel teachers and writers in the UK with a BA with honors in comparative religion, including angelology and mysticism, postgraduate certificates in spiritual development and facilitation and adult education, and over 15 years of experience teaching and presenting. She is the author of four previous books, and she is also one of only seven acknowledged and authorized spiritual educators within the Spiritual Companions Program founded by Dr. William Bloom. She's also a writer and she was voted Best Love Lightworker by Kindred Spirit Readership in 2013. We're so glad to have her with us. Chrissy, welcome to the program today.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
So when we talk about angels, as I said in the intro, a lot of times people think of them, oh, that's just something in the movies. But you think they're a lot more than that, don't you?
Oh, absolutely, definitely. I always find it really interesting when people think of it as some kind of fictitious, mythological character, rather like Father Christmas or the Tooth Fairy, because people have had real, tangible experiences that they put down as supernatural, and they call them angels. So I've come across hundreds and hundreds of people who've had this kind of experience. I can't dismiss it as fiction.
So the angels, when we think about them, we get certain pictures. We think of beings, light beings with wings, and they're playing a harp on a cloud. But what, in your view, from your experience, what are angels really like?
Well, people see this vision of an angel rather like a person, a human being with wings, because that's how they've been brought up to believe they are. But for me, angels are energy. It's light energy. We now know through science that every cell in our body contains light. We know we can't live without light. And we know that we love it. You know, we feel energized when the sun's shining. But this light has different vibrational qualities. And it's this highest vibrational quality of pure light that I believe is angelic. But we have to try really hard to get away from the that attachment to the word angel, because angel just means messenger. So I think really what we're talking about here is some kind of high vibrational divine quality that we can associate with creation, and we can associate with whatever we believe to be that aspect of divine that we may call God. So for me, angels are an energy of pure light, pure love, and they inspire us. And, you know, I come across it in my work. I come across it all the time in the circles that I move. So for me, it's really tangible. It's as tangible as someone's life being saved by a stranger, and then that stranger disappears. It's as tangible as the inspiration of the muses. You know, the people that wrote the marvelous classical music and painted the wonderful paintings were all inspired by something. And I think it's that kind of energy that we're tapping into. So for me, it's let's get away from this outmoded and somewhat dated concept that angels are like the guardian angel pictures of old, and let's try and aspire to some high vibrational quality that can change our lives. So that's what I'm trying to introduce to people.
So if I understand correctly, in your view, angels can take various forms. So they could take human form to help somebody like that person alongside the road, or they could be a spark of inspiration for a great composer. Because so many times when you talk to songwriters or authors, they say, you know, I got this great idea. I don't know where it came from. In your view, it's from angels.
Well,
sometimes
when you say it like that, it makes it sound a bit lightweight. But I think that inspiration, if we can think of angels as a quality, a divine quality, a divine inspirational quality, then yes, it comes from that source. Yeah.
Now, you talk in your book about seven steps into angel light. I want to know about why there are seven steps, but first I want to know how you define angel light. What are we stepping into exactly?
We're stepping into it's a higher vibrational energy, and I don't want to sound all new age on you, but it's just a higher quality, if you like. We're stepping into something that raises us, that makes us feel good, that's good for our health, our well-being, our mental energy, and our spiritual energy. So we're raising ourselves above the normal, mundane, run-of-the-mill energy that circulates in the bad news, the bad press, the feeling ill, that kind of humdrum. We're rising above it. And that's what I'm calling angel light. So it's an inspiration coming from divine, and that kind of mystical quality that we can't quite put our finger on, that people have been trying to find the answer to for centuries. That's what we're aiming for. So for me, there are different qualities. It's rather like a massive rainbow, and we step through each of those colors until we get to the purest enlightenment, if you like. If you want to call it enlightenment, that's what we're aiming towards.
Now, you talk about seven steps. Why seven steps?
Seven is a magical, mystical number. And seven crops up in so many worldwide contexts. You know, we have the seven oceans, we have the seven continents, we have the 7 days of the week, we have the seven colors of the rainbow. And biblically and historically, there are said to be seven great angels residing in the heavens, whatever the heavens are to everybody. And so I've researched these seven archangels or seven angels probably for the last 20 years. And it seems a really good way to introduce people to different types of spiritual energy. I keep referring to this word energy, but for me, that's really the only thing I can call it, because it's something that we feel, not necessarily see, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, one of the things I believe you talk about for this process is meditation. Where does meditation come into the picture?
Meditation for me is in the form of being calm. It's finding an inner peace. It's taking a moment to be still. And for a lot of people now, there's this buzzword, mindfulness, being in the moment and calming yourself down. So meditation is a way of stilling. And when you still yourself, you become quieter in the mind. You become quieter and you're able to hear and see and feel more clearly. So if we want inspiration for whatever ever aspect of our lives we feel we need it, whether it's healing or whether it's writing or, you know, it's a change of occupation or a new relationship, then if we calm and still and find a few moments, that's when we can connect more deeply to our higher self or our inner knowing or our, you know, our soul, if you like. So if we're wanting to connect to divine qualities that I call angels, then let's make a space for that. And let's call it meditation. So it's different from the Buddhist meditation, which is emptying. This is a way of stilling and calling in a message or perhaps a higher knowing from within oneself, or indeed connecting to the angels.
So it's stilling and filling.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, stilling and filling. Yeah.
Now you talk about the archangels, and a lot of times people hear them talked about and spoken about, but they really don't know who they are. Tell us a little bit about the archangels, and do you have a favorite?
Well, I don't really have a favorite. People have asked me, which one do you work with? You know, as if there is just one. I feel as if these seven that I refer to a lot and were referred to way back in the beginning. These are the seven that are spoken of in Theosophy, which is the Theosophical Society started at the turn of the 19th century. So there's nothing new about this. These seven beings, if you like, light beings, are also referred to in lots of the world religions. So they're aspects of creation. And for me, the one that most people have heard of is Gabriel, because most people have heard the Christmas story. Then the next one that people have heard of is Michael, Archangel Michael, particularly if they belong to a Catholic Christian background, they've heard of Archangel Michael. But then there are five others that are less known. So there's Raphael, for example, who's the great healer. There's a beautiful energy called Camuel, which is all about love and compassion. And that's the one associated with the message of the great teachers such as Buddha and Jesus, you know, that brought compassion. That particular angel is associated with that. Then there's a lovely angel called Jophiel, which most people have never heard of, which brings that energy of the sun, which makes us feel happy and alive and creative. And then there's another amazing energy called Zadkiel, which is all about transformation. And this brings the energy of the violet light. So we can look at amethysts, or we can look at lavender, or we can look at any form of violet light and feel lifted and enthused. And then there's the one called Uriel. Uriel is the one that I see as being the guardian of the earth itself. So it's very grounding. So for me, you see, working with these energies, these angels, is not so much about being way out there and fluffy and light. It's about bringing that light through us and being practical and having our feet firmly on the ground and working in the best way we know how to raise ourselves and to help others along the way too. So it's about serving, really. It's not just about me finding my angel and then making my life better. It's about how can I bring that spark of light into the real world and enable other people to feel that energized and bring that spark of light. Yeah, that's what it's all about for me. Does that answer that question? I rambled a bit there.
Now, in the book, you have an appendix, Table of the Chakras. Where do chakras come to play in this?
Well, these, I don't know how many of your listeners are really aware of the energy in those chakras. These are the seven major energy centers on our own physical body. When we're feeling unwell, or we're feeling out of sorts, or we're feeling out of balance with life, it's usually because one of these energy centers in our body is blocked or unhealthy. And the angels, or these energies that I'm talking of as angels, these will help us to unblock by enabling us and inspiring us to let go of the things that we're hanging on to in our emotions and helping us to heal. So they're very important, because that's part of the physical body. And that working with the angelic realms is about our spiritual life. So what I'm trying to do is teach people how to harness and contain that spiritual energy and filter it through the physical body so that we're well and healthy and happy. It's all about practicality for me. I mean, I'm an ex-nurse and I've run a transport company, so I'm not fluffy. I'm really down to earth. And for me, it's bringing that you know, stepping into that angel light, but in order to bring it down and anchor it here on this lovely earth with all our friends and our family and everybody we come into contact with.
Now, you mentioned, you actually kind of predicted one of my questions, practical examples. Now, I know you work with individuals. Obviously, we don't want names or anything like that, but do you have some stories of some ways that people have maybe had issues in their life or things, and they've brought the power of angels in, and how did that go for them?
Yes, I do. Because part of my work is to sort of coach people on an individual basis, but also writing for magazines in a very practical, down-to-earth, daily way. But I get lots of questions like, how can I change my relationship? How can I heal a rift in my family? Things like that. And one of the lovely ways we can work with this is to cut the ties that are binding us to the mundane or the troublesome or the challenge. So if we have a really difficult relationship from the past that's kind of haunting us because we're constantly reminded of that challenge, we can call the Archangel Michael. We can ask that we can use that sword to cut through the ties. As you may know, Archangel Michael is the one that's always depicted wearing armor with a sword in his hand. And we can, in our, if you like, imagination or in our vision, we can call upon that to bring that sword down and cut away at the chains and the ties that are binding us. And so I teach people very practical exercises that they can do. And I have seen such incredible changes, real transformations, particularly in my workshops and talks, where I always introduce little exercises that people can take something away with them, little tools that they can use in everyday life. Working with the angelic energies as well can bring a lot of love back into your life. So if people have, say, for example, they've had a big fallout with someone at work or in their family, they can ask the angelics to help them to forgive and to move on from that argument by somehow helping them to shift the way they perceive that argument to have been and realize that they had a part in it too. So I try to teach people that we all have part in every action that outplays, and to forgive ourselves and forgive the other person is really hard. So I teach them ways of being able to do that step by step by calling in the angels to help them to do that, to show them ways where they can be more gentle or more forgiving. And I've seen some incredible shifts and some real transformations. It's very hard to talk about individual cases. Sometimes I help with people's grief. Sometimes I help with people moving house or changing jobs by enhancing that aspect of themselves that they can believe in. It's teaching people how to quieten and be peaceful and bring that divine energy in, and calling it a name is a really easy way of doing it. So if I say, okay, you've got some problem with your body, let's call upon the healing energy of Archangel Raphael to bring that energy around you and help you to heal. When we sit with that in a group, it can really, really transform the energy. And that's what people feel. Most of us have an empathy. Most of us can feel energy. It's tangible. You know, you walk into a room and you know somebody's had an argument, you can feel it. They don't need to say anything, you can just feel it. And so when we're doing a group meditation or a group exercise, that feeling becomes tangible and it's transformational.
Well, the angels help us unsolicited, or do they tend to come in when they're asked?
I think they're always there, unsolicited. But they can't step in and help us unless we ask them to, because we are the ones with free will. You know, the human being is the one with the free will, and the angels tend to come on and help us when we call them. But don't forget, I mean, it's not just, you know, we're not kids constantly saying, I want, it's not like a Christmas list. If they're here to serve us, we're also there to serve them. So it works best when it's a two-way arrangement and it's a two-way relationship. I always feel that once we've raised our own spiritual energy, then we're prepared to serve the greater good and the higher purpose. So it's a two-way thing, really.
Even someone that's worked in this for such a great amount of time, does anything ever surprise you about the angels?
Well, I've been doing this work now for over 20 years, and yes, it does. It never ceases to amaze me, for example, in a really childlike way, when I have a new set of cards that's just coming out, but my own cards were inspired. Each one of them was individually inspired. And when I'm sitting with someone and we've discussed their issues, their challenges, and we've worked out how best to move forward on those challenges, then I'll suggest, should we just take one of these cards and see what the angels are saying? And it never ceases to amaze me how accurate they are. So yes, the magic never ceases for me. The surprise factor never ceases for me, whether that's because I'm just particularly childlike, even though I'm getting on in the years, or whether it's just that that's what keeps it alive for me, is this element of surprise in people's lives when those synchronicities happen, those coincidences, and the marvelous appearance of the right message, the right picture, that sense of knowing that people achieve when they start to shift from disbelief to maybe, and then from maybe to very likely, and then from very likely to, oh my gosh, this really works. I love that transformation. That's what makes my work so fabulous, and that's why I have such a passion for it, because it's never jaded, it's never tarnished for me. That light is always shining bright, and especially so when somebody just gets it, you know, when they've been really cynical or really skeptical. Just a very quick story, a friend of mine from the past, from what I call my previous life, when I was nursing, and she was a real disbeliever. It was all a load of nonsense, never heard such bunkum. And then her husband bought a sports car, and he was driving it home from where he bought it, and he ran into a thick fog. Now, he kept on going in a very kind of obstinate way, and because it was a new sports car, he was still driving too fast, and he went off the road. Then the fog, or this heavy, heavy mist, was too thick for him to see. He just got out of his car and he stepped back onto the road. But when the mist cleared, his wheels were actually not just off the road. He'd come to a ravine, a cliff side. The road was quite a steep drop on the other side. And this sports car would have surely rolled and he would have been killed. So he said to his wife, well, I'm not sure what Chrissy, you know, I don't know what it is that she believes in, but I really think that one of those angels of hers was on my side today. So, you see, sometimes when people really are sure it's not true, and then something like that happens, they're willing to hold it lightly. They're willing to say, well, maybe. And then if I can gently, without imposing or without pushing my point, if I can then show them that there are lots of other cases where that happened too, and maybe there is some truth in it, maybe we do have guardians looking after us called angels, maybe there is some light that we can step into and make our lives slightly better, then, you know, that's what my job's all about, really.
Some of the things you mentioned in the book, one of them is awakening to your soul's purpose. And somebody might be out there saying, well, you know, I'm just, file records at some big institution or something. That sounds kind of antiquated. I don't even know if people do that anymore. But they have maybe a mundane job or nothing that they would consider exciting, and they'll say, well, I don't have something like that. But I'm guessing that you would say that's a misnomer, and we all have a sole purpose.
Yeah, I would say that. Lots of people say to me, I hate my job. I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm sure I'm here to do something else or something better or something different. And I would say, wherever you are, there is a reason why you're there. And perhaps you're the one who people can come to because you have a really comforting way about you and people feel better having spoken to you. Or maybe in that mundane job, you have a sense of humor and people enjoy being in your company. Or maybe you're just doing something a little different in your way. Maybe you have a faith or a hope or there is some light in you that others see that you can't. So I say, whatever the job you're doing, if you do it the best way you can, if you do it by showing an example of kindness, by caring, by being the one that smiles or brings in that extra cup of coffee for the person who's had a bad time recently, then you're in the right place and you are fulfilling your soul's purpose. But once somebody says to themselves, well, I wonder why I'm here doing this, and I wonder if there's something else I can be doing, then that's when they're at the point of the realization that perhaps there is something more that they could be doing. And in the meantime, just do what you are doing to the best of your capacity.
Well, I think that's a great note to close out on. Chrissy, where can people find more information about your book? And I know that I believe you consult with people individually and a whole range of services. Where can people find everything about Chrissy Estelle?
They can find me on angellight.co.uk.
Very good. 7 steps into Angel Light. A journey of self-discovery and spiritual empowerment. Our guest has been Chrissy Estelle. Chrissy, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thanks very, very much, Jim. Bye.
Angels, a subject that always fascinates, and we thank Chrissy for stopping by and telling us about her work. And next, the topic on tap, our out-of-body experiences. And here they are. And looking forward to this because we're going to talk about a topic that has always fascinated me, and we have a great guest to discuss it, Iris Christ. She is the author of the book, I Have Seen It Tomorrow, and the subject are all about out-of-body states, out-of-body experiences. Iris first experienced her first out-of-body experience back in 1995. Since then, she devotes all of her free time to the study of OBEs. She's also interested in quantum physics, free energy, anomalous cognition, near-death experiences, and topics connected to merging science and religion. She holds 3 degrees. She studied in the former USSR and USA and Slovakia. Her majors studied include law, journalism, Russian area studies, management, and phytomathology, which I've never heard of before. I'll have to ask her what it is. Iris, welcome to the program today. How are you?
I'm fine, and great to be here with you, Jim. And actually, Iris is my pen name, as I said, it's my pseudonym, and my real name is Julia Sellers, but you can, call me Julia, Iris, whatever.
Okay.
So it's a great pleasure for me to be here with you.
Okay, Julia. I just wanted to make sure you didn't mind that because we're on the air, as it were, we're recording, so I wanted to make sure you were okay with that. So good to speak with you today. So obviously, you have a lot of academic background, but you're studying something that by most people is considered very spiritual and maybe not as academically based. Talk to us about that experience in 1995 and how you got into all of this.
Well, basically, my first out-of-body experience, occurred back in 1994 or 1995. And I don't really remember how it started. All I remember is getting those weird, out-of-body states. And, I would wake up in the middle of the night and suddenly I would realize, oh, my God, I see my physical body okay, sleeping on the bed. But I was watching my body from the ceiling, and I knew it was me. I knew it was my body that was fast asleep. I was on the ceiling. So whatever part, you know, left my body, I call, you know, you might want to call it consciousness, a quantum of energy, the soul, or, you know, the parasomatic body, etheric body. So I was able to actually watch my physical body from the ceiling. And the funny thing was that all of my senses, right, were intact. I was able actually to hear stuff that was going on outside on the street. You know, I was able to listen to the TV show that my roommate was watching at the time. So my physical body was laying on the bed. I was up on the ceiling. I was able to hear voices coming from a street. I was listening to the TV show that my roommate was watching at the time. I was able to see things around me in my room. But the way I was able to see was something that's called circular or global vision. 360 degrees around. So what I'm saying is that I was able to see what was happening in front of me, behind me, from the side, and it was kind of scary. I'm like, okay, what's happening? Now, when you look at the topic of out-of-body experiences, right? Normally, the researchers or the science would define a typical out-of-body experience as something that it's an experience in which a person seems to be awake, okay? So either you're awake, so what's happening to you is being done under full consciousness. You are not asleep. So number one, you're awake. Number two, you are able to see or watch your physical body and the environment around from a location outside your physical body. And this is important. You have to be able to watch yourself from outside your physical body, because if you were watching yourself from inside of your of a physical body, like say in the mirror, right, you see yourself in the mirror, that would not be out of body experience, but that would be defined by the science as otoscopy or heautoscopy or otoscopic hallucinations. Now, out of body experience rather is something that, number one, you're awake, right? So you're not dreaming. Because if you were dreaming, that would be called lucid dreaming or astral travel, astral projection. But full-blown out-of-body experience actually happens when you are fully awake. So in the waking state, right, under full consciousness, you see your own body from a floating perspective, right? So you are watching your body from above, right? And you see your own physical body from a location outside your material physical body, if that makes sense. I know it sounds confusing, but this is what's happening, right? And, you know, the topic of out-of-body experiences, actually, you know, you have a, you know, fair amount of studies that would approach out-of-body experiences as something occurring in the pathological population, right? You would have, you know, different clinical situations, pathologies like schizophrenia, epilepsy, and what you have. But there is a severe lack of studies aimed at researching out-of-body experiences occurring in the non-pathological population, in the healthy population, so to speak. Now, you know, people report experiencing, you know, out-of-body experiences as part of near-death experiences, sure, right? Or, you know, you could have out-of-body experiences induced by, you know, hypnosis, meditation, trance, or different techniques. You know, even if you're contemplating or if you're praying, you know, you can have the out-of-body experience. Now, as I said, the out-of-body experiences would be happening under, you know, different ictal seizures, epilepsy, you know, cardiac arrests, you know, brain injuries, you know, life-threatening situations. And, you know, or a sudden shock, right? Or activities such as, you know, extreme exercising, or they might be illicit. They might be elicited by, you know, electrodes that would be put, you know, on your brain or inside of your brain. So what I'm saying is that but out-of-body experiences that are happening with the healthy population are quite seldom, or at least people who have them either do not speak out for different reasons, or, you know, they might be ashamed, they're confused, they don't know what's happening to them. So basically, the available literature that we have on out-of-body experiences would be mostly, you know, studies done with the, as I said prior, the pathological population, right? Now, with respect to out-of-bodies that are happening to me or to Michael, my husband, I mean, these are out-of-body experiences that basically Michael would have ever since he can remember. He, you know, he would leave body when he was a toddler. He would remember leaving the body, but he was so much confused with respect to what was happening to him. Number one, he thought that everyone could be, you know, could have out-of-body experiences as he had, right? He did not know until he was 18 or 19 that what he was undergoing, right, during the day under full consciousness, right, were called out-of-body experiences. He thought whatever he was experiencing, you know, his classmates were, well, you know, everyone was. But, I mean, Michael has been, being a natural psychic, you know, he's a natural psychic, he basically started with, you know, his out-of-body experiences, my God, when he was 3 or 4. You know, he remembers leaving the body as a toddler, and his out-of-body experiences occur every day, you know, sometimes, you know, more often, sometimes less, depending on the weather, the season, the emotional state, the moon phase, you know. And he basically had out-of-body experiences and other paranormal experiences ever since he can remember. And I mean, to the point that he would actually remember being in his mother's uterus, right? And the whole prenatal stage, which is kind of like, it sounds crazy. But, you know, he says, you know, Julie, I remember how it felt. You know, I remember how it felt. I remember the exact sounds, the colors, the surroundings that I experienced in my mother uterus, right? Well, basically, when he goes out of body, you know, he would just, you know, get out of there, and he's either hovering above, watching his physical body, but sometimes he would actually fly away to different distance locations, you know, different places. You know, he can, when he's out of body, he can, you know, hear things. It happens to me too. He can hear things taking place behind walls, right? He can go through walls, okay? He can pass through the doors, because what's passing through the doors or what's passing through walls, it's not his physical body, which he left behind him. It's the, again, quantum of energy. Let's call it quantum of vibrations or oscillations, right? Rather than calling it a soul or, you know, or etheric body. So basically, he would pass through walls, doors, right? He can hear, you know, things happening at far distances, you know. Now, he can pick up emotions. He can pick up thoughts or ideas and feelings of other people, you know. He communicates telepathically. When out of body, you know, as I said prior, the part of the energy quantum, we can call it higher self or soul, whatever we want to call it, right? Mm-hmm. It gets extended beyond the physical body, beyond the borders of the physical body, and it goes into the greater space-time continuum, right? So when Michael feels like traveling, you know, he would just leave the body and he would just travel around. You know, he can travel anywhere he wants to. You know, he can travel different places, different countries, different dimensions, different galaxies. You know, basically, if he feels like, you know, exploring certain place, he would just leave a body and just get there. He would get there instantaneously just by, like, thinking about it.
Is this something that's accessible to everyone to some degree, or is it just certain people who are very talented?
Well, I think that the potential is there for everyone. It's just a matter of having the ability to wake up, so to speak, having the ability to run on certain vibrations, certain frequency. If you hit certain frequency, out-of-body experiences happen naturally. It's just a matter of how to get to the frequency, right? And people use different techniques. People use different technology. They use meditation. They use different auditory input into your ears, right? In order to be able to get out of body, right? There's different techniques for getting out of body. But again, I mean, the out-of-body experiences that happen naturally, organically, spontaneously, like it's happening with Michael, or it happened to me back in the 90s, right? I didn't ask for that. Michael certainly didn't ask for that. He did not even know until he was 18, 19 that what was happening to him, you know, were out-of-body experiences. And as a matter of fact, he wants to get rid of it. He wants to stay grounded in the body. He doesn't know how to do that. He cannot control the out-of-body experience, right? He says, like, oh my God, well, again, I'm out of body, you know. So basically what I'm saying, yeah, I mean, out-of-body experiences, I think the potential is there with everyone. It's about the ability to be able to run a certain frequency. Now, you know, I would say that certain people are born with different qualities, or, you know, they have different, they can have, they're more prone to experiences paranormal than others are. It's about the genetics. It's about, there's a different things. But what I'm saying is that you can either learn how to get out of body. But my question is, well, why would I want to learn that? You know, why would I want to enforce it up in my physical body unless it happens naturally, unless it happens organically? If it does, there's a reason why. You know, it tells you your body is ready. You're ready to go elsewhere. You're ready to live or to hit higher dimension, so to speak. So I think, yeah, the potential is there, and it's up to an individual to either to, you know, to practice or to go and take special classes that would teach you, you know, how to get out of body. You know, it happens naturally, as I said, organically, but not that many people are, you know, lucky enough to experience spontaneous, natural, organic out-of-body experiences. Yes.
Is this something that you go into some kind of trance to induce?
No, it's not a trance. As I said, it might be, but out-of-body experience happens while your consciousness, while you basically enter the so-called altered state of consciousness. But you have many different levels of entering the altered state of consciousness. So no, you do not have to necessarily enter into a trance in order to get out of body. Because as I said, you know, with Michael, we would walk on the street and the next thing I know, he's out of body, right? So there was no trance, there was no preparation, there was no prior meditation. So he doesn't take no time to get out of body. It just happens in 1 second. You know, boom, he's out of body. It happens while he's walking, you know, drinking coffee, working on a computer, doing whatever, right? So for him, it happens like that. But as I said, there are different states of out of body and different techniques of how to achieve or attain or gain an out of body experience, right? Now, yeah, it's some, you know, like Edgar Case, right? He would be getting out-of-body experiences under trance. He would not have a regular out-of-body experience unless he got into the state of trance, right? Now, different shamans, you know, shamanic dancers, you know, shamans that you have in Amazon, yeah, they will have out-of-body experiences that would be induced by dancing, certain moving, different movements of physical body, dancing, and entering into certain level of a trance. But again, it's not necessarily with certain people to get into a trance or into, you know, an altered state of consciousness in order to get out of body. So you have different gifted psychics, gifted people that would be, you know, just spontaneously slip into the out of body, right? So it works differently with different people. But mostly what I'm aware of, you know, the different classes that there are available, different workshops that would teach you how to get out of body, they would talk about different induction techniques. So they would tell you, oh, you have to induce it, right? Now, you can induce out of body by certain way of breathing, right? You can have so-called belly breathing, where you try to breathe with your belly versus your chest, right? Or you can have enforced quick breathing where you would be kind of like switching from the right side on the nose to the left side on the nose, and you would be really kind of like the breathing would go like really quick, and that's when you can get out of body. But again, I said, you know, as I said earlier, I mean, it's up to you. You know, you want to experience out of body experience, You have to understand that, you know, it just does not happen like that, you know, that you have to probably take certain courses, certain, you know, you have to go through different techniques in order to get out of body, unless you're fortunate enough to be a natural, organic, out of body experiencer. So this is probably what's, you know, what's happening.
Now, there's some things you talk about in your book I'd like to go over, and a few that have caught my attention. One of them is in chapter one, the idea of being fully conscious during birth. Talk to us about that one, because that sounds fascinating.
It sounds fascinating, and this is what happened to Michael. He basically had been through the so-called conscious birth. Conscious birth is a situation when basically the child that's being born is fully conscious and he or she is able to watch their own birthing the process of birth, that the, you know, the mother is birthing the child and the child is so awake, or so conscious, that basically he or she is able to watch that. Now, that happened to Michael. He remembers the birth of his mother. When his mother was giving birth to him. And he just remembers that. And he says that that's something that he almost fainted. He kind of like was watching it, but the way he was watching it was from a perspective of an adult mind. So yeah, he was a baby, right? He was a newborn, but his perception of watching his own birth was from a perspective of an adult mind, if that makes sense to you. So it's something that, you know, he was, as I said, he was fully conscious and aware even prior his birth. He remembers spending time in his uterus, in his mother's uterus. He remembers the instant when he was flown into his mother's uterus. And I know it sounds crazy, but he would tell me, you know, Julie, I remember when I was flown into my mother's uterus. What does it mean to be, you know, flown into, you know, your mother's uterus? So he remembers entering his mother's uterus as a flash of light, as an instance of light, right? So he says, I came in the form of light. And that's fascinating because, you know, we can call it a light. We can call it a soul entering the fetus. We can call it electromagnetic, you know, quantum of energy. Not only electromagnetic, but also, vibrational mode of waves, which would not be electromagnetic, but rather a longitudinal vibrational kind of waves that are compressional, and they are not of electromagnetic origin, but rather of sound origin, vibrational origin. It's a mixture of sound and light together. One part is horizontally oriented. These waves we call longitudinal sound vibrations. The other part would be called light. And light is vertical electromagnetic radiation. So sound and light together would form what we call the soul, right? Or the quantum of energy entering the fetus, right? So yeah, he would be talking about these things to me, and I would put the things down for myself in my diary. And I was, you know, writing the diary for, I've been doing that for over 20 years now. And then I would put the, you know, pieces together, and, you know, I published the book. And, you know, so these kind of things, believe it or not, are happening. I know it sounds crazy. And, you know, some of the listeners might say, oh, it's a bull. You know, I don't believe it. But, you know, you have certain portion of, you know, public or listeners or people that would be very much open to this kind of information. And
now,
so, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. And to me, the thing, and I'd like to get your reaction to this, and we might call it supernatural. It might be some kind of science yet that's not fully understood. But the idea that someone can go out of their body and then they report seeing themselves, and then they report, for example, in the case of near-death experiences, seeing things that they, quote, shouldn't be able to see. To me, it indicates that this is something that's real and something that either has some kind of supernatural component or some kind of science we don't understand. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, it's definitely, we can call it paranormal, right? Supernatural. But, you know, if you look at it from a scientific point of view, you can look at different brain scans or the neural correlates of people who were experiencing spontaneous out-of-body experiences. And I'm talking about a healthy population. There's a couple of studies out there that would talk about the EEG, that would talk about the brain activity while, you know, the healthy population would be able, I mean, the individuals, you know, like Ingo Swan or Miss Z or, you know, Alex Tanis, to name just a few. They were basically watched by researchers, and what their, you know, brain scans show while undergoing out-of-body experiences. And again, these were natural, spontaneous out-of-body experiences of people that are, you know, that would be considered healthy populations, right? So what the brain scans reveal would be that basically you would have brain activity mostly on the right side of the brain in the regions that would have to do with temporal lobe, parietal lobe, and occipital lobe. And, you know, the TPJ region of a brain, temporal parietal junction of a brain, would show, you know, heightened activity during the out-of-body experiences, right? Now, if we just talk about Ingo Swan, he was a famous, you know, remote viewer.
Sure.
When he was remote viewing, right? And now the question is, was he out-of-body? Was he not, right? He might have been. He might have, you know, underwent a full out-of-body experience while remote viewing. Now, the brain scans would show that actually he would in the occipital region on the right side of a brain, an occipital region is back on your head, right, where you have like vision and stuff. So the occipital region would show some abnormal discharge in the form of 7 hertz frequency spike, right, spike of wave activity. And those discharges actually would kind of like, as I said, they would be in the occipital region of the brain and bilateral. They would start in on the right side, and they would also be detected on the left side, right? Now, the possible source of the 7 hertz wave activity might be, as the researchers, you know, think about it, might be the amygdalar region or that's region connected to limbic system, connected with emotions, right? But also there were temporal and parietal cortexes involved. Now, you would say, you know, the 7 hertz actually is alpha brain waves, right? Alpha brain waves. It's kind of like on the border with theta, right? Which already is dreaming, but 7 hertz alpha, right? Alpha brain waves is not dreaming or even the drowsiness. It's something between wakeful state and between kind of like falling asleep, something like we would call, you know, hypnagogia, right?
Sure.
Basically, you know, it's, but what I'm saying is that, so that was Ingo Swan. Now we could talk about Alex Tanis. Alex Tanis was a natural gifted psychic who would have natural out-of-body experience similar to Michael's, right? And basically he was studied by Dr. Osis, right? Dr. Osis. And as far as I can remember, you know, Dr. Osis would come up with measurements that would show a decrease in electroactivity in the back of Alex's head, in the occipital region, the same that happened with Ingo Swan, right? And again, it would be in alpha region. And so the same would happen to Miss Z back in the 70s. Charles Tart, you know, he did a great experiment with Miss, it was a wife or girl. He would call her Miss Z. But Ms. Z would, you know, experience, you know, spontaneous out of body experiences. And so Charles would study her, you know, for the, I think for nine or eight, you know, nights in a row. And basically what happened is that Charles figured that, hey, when she was out of body, I could see some, you know, flattened EEG with the alpha activity. Actually, it would be less than alpha. It would be, you know, we're talking alpha, it could be 10 hertz or 9 hertz, but it would be the so-called alphoid activity. You know, Charles would term it as alphoid activity, and there would be no REM, no REM or no skin resistance activity. There would be a normal heart rate, right? But the lady would be out of body, which really is very interesting. And when we look at Inga Swan, you know, Alex Tanis and Ms. Z, I can see some similarities to what the research actually showed. You know, the alpha activity, you know, that would be on the right side of the brain. It would be in the occipital region, or more or less on the border, you know, parietal region, temporal parietal, occipital region. And again, the TPJ region, the temporal parietal junction, would be involved. So it's kind of like, I would say that we need more research into the out-of-body experiences of healthy population. But the question is, where to get the experiencers? Because as I said, you know, Michael is not ready to get out of the closet either. You know, he says, you know, I'm kind of like, you know, it's happening to me since I was 3 or 4, but I don't want to talk about it, you know? So I'm working on Michael to kind of get out of the closet, you know? But he says, you know, maybe next year he would be available for researchers to at least get his neural correlate. So we're already talking to certain, you know, top researchers in America to work on Michael and to see, you know, what's happening to his brain activities when he's undergoing the full-blown out-of-body experience under full consciousness. So this is what's happening. So we'll see how it comes out, you know.
Excellent point, and we would like to follow that, so please do keep us up to date on it. The book is I Have Seen It Tomorrow. Julia Sellers, writing as Iris Christ, has been our guest. Julia, where can people find the book and connect to it?
Basically, it's available on the Amazon, and they can just type, you know, and don't go looking under Julia Sellers. It was written under my pen name, so just type in Iris Christ, K-R-S-T, or you can just go by I Have Seen It Tomorrow. And as I said, it is available on the Amazon.com. So
it is a very interesting subject. Thank you for joining us today, Julia. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. And it's a pleasure to be here with you. And I hope we can, you know, we can meet some other time in the future.
Sounds good. Well, thank you for tuning into The Other Side. We appreciate it and appreciate you being a Plus member, because at the end of the day, without you, we could not do this full time and could not put out nearly as many shows as we do. So thank you, and you are very much valued. We'll talk to you next time on The Other Side. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.